remembering the Sterling Hall bombing on the UW-Madison campus 50 years ago this month. It's an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The campus was a hotbed for anti-Vietnam War protests in the 60s and 70s. After the Dow Day riot in 67, the anti-war movement in Madison grew more forceful. That is, until the bombing of Sterling Hall in August 1970. It shocked the nation and was labeled the death of the peace movement. The bombing killed physics researcher Robert Fastnacht. What do you remember about the Vietnam War protests from this area? Do you remember the Sterling Hall bombing? Were you there? How did the movement against the war change our culture? We're at 800-642-1234. Stuart Levitan is an attorney, politician, and historian in Madison. His most recent book is called Madison in the 60s, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Stu, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be with you, Kate.
Well, set the stage for us, if you will. What was happening in the late 60s with the anti-war movement? What was it like around the country and in Madison?
It was not good, Kate. It's hard for people, I think, to recall, and would be hard for people who didn't experience it to understand what it was like to have regular trashings and regular firebombings and regular semi-riots in the streets. Starting, where do you want me to start? Because the anti-war movement goes through so many different phases, from the picketing and the protesting to the peaceful sitting in to what you refer to as the Dow Day riot, and increasing levels of violence, so that by late 1969, we see Carl Armstrong firebombing buildings on the campus, trying to bomb from an airplane. The Badger Ordnance Works in Baraboo. Across the country, there's a tremendous amount of violence through 1969, 1970. In Madison in particular, the year 1970 starts with the New Year's gang with a group vandalizing the Army Reserve Center on Park Street. Carl Armstrong firebombs the Red Gym on January 3rd, tries to firebomb the Selective Service Building on January 4th, but ends up bombing the Primate Lab. There's 2,500 people marching against campus recruiters in February. There's 1,000 people rampaging around campus in late February. And then we see things going on around the country. In March 1970, two weathermen blow themselves up at 18 West 11th Street in New York City. Diana Houghton and Terry Robbins are killed. In May 1970, we get to Kent State and Jackson State. And the situation in Madison in May 1970 is horrific. For 5 nights in Madison after Cambodia and Kent State, the city burned. There was a tremendous amount of arson. There were thousands of people in the street. There were fire bombings. There was the National Guard was here. There was so much tear gas poured out night after night after night that for weeks, as you walked around campus and walked up Bascom Hill and you kicked a tuft of grass, clouds of tear gas would rise up. So the situation in 1970 is alive with ongoing threats and ongoing danger, and it all leads inexorably in some people's minds to what happens on the early morning of August 24th, 1970.
With the Sterling Hall bombing on August 24th, 1970, what kind of research was going on in Sterling Hall? Why was it the focus of protesters?
Well, there is some disagreement about exactly what research was going on. Certainly, there was research being conducted for the Army. That's why the Army paid for it. It was the Army Mathematics Research Center, and it had opened in 1955-56, and the university did not hide or pretend that it wasn't connected to the Army. Because this was part of the Cold War university. In the 50s and 60s, the threat of the Cold War, the threat of Soviet Union was pouring a lot of money into campuses, research campuses like the University of Wisconsin, University of California, Berkeley, Ann Arbor, and so on. And in March 28th, 1969, Jim Rowan writes a copyrighted article in the Daily Cardinal with the headline, "You Research AIDS ABM Army Munitions." And the role of the Daily Cardinal and Jim Rowan, as well as the Kaleidoscope coming on, is critical and central to what happened, because Jim Rowan was a tremendous investigative reporter and was a dogged researcher and got documents and was able to analyze exactly what Army Math was doing. And the conclusion, to most people's satisfaction, was it was doing research that mathematics research that aided the Army in terms of ballistics and in terms of seeing through the canopy of the jungle. It's complicated mathematics stuff that I don't fully understand the technology of, but there was Army-related research. And by the fall of 1969, by October 1969, Army Math off-campus was one of SDS's three demands: ROTC off-campus, the Land Tenure Center shutdown, and Army Math off-campus. So it was a focal point of people's frustrations. And at one point, the physics department, and people would regularly throw rocks through windows and try and disrupt activities at Army Math. And at one point, the director of the physics lab put a sign on the window saying, "We're the physics lab. Army Math is upstairs." And J. Barclay Rosser, the director of Army Math, made them take it down.
Oh, goodness.
Now, interestingly, the first, at least to people in Madison, the first director of the Army Math Research Center was a man named Rudolf Langer, who was the head of the mathematics department. And for people in Madison, Rudolf Langer is the man who gave his lithographs to the he was the head of the Madison Art Association, the precursor to the Madison Arts Center and the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art's first great collection was from Rudolf Langer, the first head of the Army Math Research Center.
I want to introduce you. Stu Levitan is a historian whose most recent book is Madison in the 60s. We're remembering the Sterling Hall bombing 50 years ago this month with your memories as well at 800-642-1234. Stu, take us back to those pre-dawn hours on August 24th, 1970. What happened?
The New Year's gang, which had been planning this for some time, that's Carlton Armstrong, Dwight Armstrong, Leo Burt, and David Fine, had a plan to blow up the Army, blow up Sterling Hall, where the Army Math Research Center was located, and with what's called an ANFO bomb, ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which had tremendous explosive power. They packed a Ford Econoline with fertilizer and fuel oil, and their assumption was that at 3:30 in the morning, Sterling Hall would be empty, that there would be nobody doing research, and Dwight and David Fine, Park, the Corvair that Dwight took from his mom for a getaway. And David Fine goes to call the police to warn them, "Pigs, the building's about to blow. This is no BS. Clear the building." Leo Burt and Carl Armstrong park the Ford Econoline next to the building, and there are lights on, and there's some bicycles there. And there's, wait a minute, the building is supposed to be empty. And they have second thoughts, and Carl is momentarily sort of paralyzed with, "Well, my goodness, there may be somebody here." And he recognizes that there may be somebody in the building. He looks around and he says, "Well, we're here. It's too late to stop now." He lights the fuse and they run to the car and they're on their way out of town.
And we have to pause there with Madison historian Stu Levitan. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're remembering the Sterling Hall bombing on the UW-Madison campus 50 years ago this month. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the pre-dawn hours of August 24th, 1970, a powerful explosion ripped through Sterling Hall. The bombing was planned by four anti-Vietnam War radicals. It was the worst act of domestic terrorism in our country until the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Do you remember Sterling Hall? What is your story from that time? Join in 800-642-1234. Madison historian Stu Leviton stays with us. Now we're joined by David Schuster as well. His life was dramatically changed by the bombing. He is an associate professor of physics and science education at Western Michigan University. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thanks very much.
Can you explain for us what you were doing on that day?
Oh, yes. Well, by way of context, I was an international graduate student from South Africa, come to Madison to do research for my PhD in physics. So on that particular day, or night rather, I was working through the night on my experimental work on the accelerator, which is a research machine in the basement level of Stirling. I would have been working right through until the next morning taking data and results. So probably was about just after 3 a.m., I left the accelerator room and I went along to the graduate student offices to get some reading material. I almost went to my own desk, which turns out to have been directly where they placed the truck with the bomb outside. But for some reason, I decided to get reading material from another graduate office across the way. As I did, I saw in the hallway Robert Fasnacht talking to somebody, leaning against the doorpost. Looked like he was ready to leave, had a jacket and a bag with him. I just nodded to them and went into the graduate office. And that, for some time, is the last thing I remember. So, reconstructing it after the event, the bomb went off then. I was knocked unconscious instantaneously. So the interesting thing is I have no traumatic experience of being in a bomb explosion. I know nothing of it, fortunately. I don't know how long I was unconscious, but sometime later, maybe an hour or two, I seemed to be awakening from some sort of dream state, but it didn't make sense. I was in the dark, lying on my back, covered with rubble and debris. There was water rising slowly under me. My head and one arm were free, and that was it. I couldn't see. It was dark. Anyway, this made no sense. I rejected the idea. I remember, and thought I'd go back to sleep. Anyway, I think I drifted in and out of consciousness several times, but it soon became clear this really was real. I really was trapped. The building, for some reason, had collapsed around there, and that was my situation. I was puzzled, of course. That's probably a mild word.
Yeah.
But I soon put that out of my mind and said, okay, the thing to do is to get out of here, whatever it is. So I tried, and the rubble was so heavy that I could remove blocks sort of one by one with one hand, but that was about it. I freed my left arm as well. Other than that, I couldn't move. I discovered by feeling around that there was a twisted metal door frame above me, and so I grabbed it with both arms, tried to pull myself up. Clearly, that wasn't going to work. My shoulder was broken. It was too painful. So at that stage, I calmed down. I always marvel at how people behave in situations like this. But I thought, I kept telling myself, wait a minute, this is real. Keep calm. Be sensible. What can you do? And so my attempts at removing the rubble, I took in phases, and eventually decided that there was nothing to do. I don't know how people react in bad situations where you know there's nothing you can do, but there's a certain calm that comes. That's what I remember.
David, do you know why you survived?
Yes. No. Well, the reason I survived, we had to reconstruct afterwards. By the way, I'm going to bring the fireman in here, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. I probably had to wait an hour or so to be rescued, and eventually I saw lights, flashlights, people calling. I called back. They said, keep calling so we can find you. The fireman came, and I thought they'd just pull me out, but they didn't. They didn't touch me. They removed every bit of rubble until I was completely clear. I remember saying, why don't you just get me out of here? They said, we have to look for spinal injuries. Can you feel your feet? And he pricked them, and etc. They decided I had no spinal injuries, put me on a stretcher, and took me out over to university hospitals. So that was the very professional job. So later I went back to thank them at the fire station some long time later, and we tried to reconstruct what happened, and this is the and we went back. The only reason I could have survived was because I must have been standing behind a building support pillar, which took the full impact of the blast, and I was in the shadow. Otherwise, I would have been killed instantly. It is absolutely clear. And this is just a matter of chance events and where you happen, 2 feet to the right or left, I would have been killed. A few minutes before or after, I might have been killed or not. And so it was, you know, a chance in 10 million. But I wasn't killed. I had injuries, but I wasn't killed. So it's just fortunate. And if I'd gone to my own desk, I would probably have been like 12 feet from the bomb. So I count myself lucky and unlucky.
I want to introduce you for a moment here, David. David Schuster is one of the survivors of the Sterling Hall bombing at UW-Madison in August of 1970. He's a physicist at Western Michigan University. Stu Levitan is here as well. Stu is a historian in Madison. Stu, another researcher, Robert Fosnock, was killed in the explosion. What can you tell us about this postgraduate student?
Well, he was brilliant. He was, as you say, a postdoctoral student. Everyone liked Robert Fosnock, married, kids. His wife, Stephanie, had nothing to do with Army math. He was a physicist doing important postdoctoral research. And it's just, you know, what the bombing would have represented if no one had been hurt or killed is one of the great imponderables, but the fact that Robert Fosnacht was killed, a man who was not supporting the war and was not involved in military research, is just an unmitigated and incomprehensible tragedy. Everyone mourns him.
David, at the time of the bombing, you, as you mentioned, were an international student from South Africa. How long did it take your family to find out what happened?
Well, that's quite interesting. That in those days, of course, there wasn't instantaneous internet and things like that. So I suggested that somebody try to call my mother or send a telegram. And I didn't realize that there would be a very short time span for this, because my relatives heard on the news that there's been a South African in the explosion, and the first news report was killed. I think they mixed things up. So this was a real problem. My mother called the called physics at Western in Madison.
Madison, mm-hmm.
And purely by chance, she got my physics advisor at the very brief time he was in his office. And so that's how she found out I'd survived.
David Schuster there, physicist at Western Michigan University. He was in Sterling Hall 50 years ago when anti-war protesters bombed it. Madison historian Stu Leviton stays with us. What do you remember about the Vietnam War protests from the late 60s and 70s? What lessons have you learned from Vietnam protests in light of demonstrations today that we see in our country? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're remembering the Sterling Hall bombing on the UW-Madison campus 50 years ago this month. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. The anti-war radicals, they targeted the hall to protest the university's research connection to the Army. The bombing killed a physics postgraduate student, and it was a turning point in the anti-war movement. How did the movement against the Vietnam War change our culture? What lessons were learned? What's been forgotten? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Madison historian Stu Leviton as our guide, and David Schuster here as well, a physicist at Western Michigan University. He was in Sterling Hall 50 years ago when anti-war protesters bombed it. David, what effect did the bombing have on your life?
Well, there's practical and philosophical. Practically, I had injuries, which I recovered from, except hearing loss, which continues. So I've adapted to that. I've managed to teach at the university since then. And the only difficulty sometimes is social situations with many people. But that's minor. And I always count myself very lucky, especially when I think of Robert and his family and his work. That's my real sadness. So as an effect on my life, that has remained, whereas I've pretty much forgotten my own bad luck in that instance.
I think about how journalists may call you every 10 years, right, on these anniversaries and have you reflect. And I'm wondering, as the decades wear on, do you think about that night? Do your memories soften in any way?
Do my memories what?
Soften in any way or change?
No, they remain as vivid as ever, I think, because it was so dramatic. Mm. They're ingrained. Only afterwards, as I think about it, it's the other issues, the political, the idea of civil disobedience, the idea of the government and wars and politicians and all of those. So there's a whole lot of that kind of thing, which I kind of analyze in a naive way in my mind afterwards to try to understand it. And I put it in the big picture, by the way. This was a bombing carried out by four people. The focus is on that most of the time. But I go back and I say, what led to this? What were the chain of events and decisions and actions and structures that led to this? And where, in fact, does the responsibility lie? So, in brief, that's the kind of thoughts that it's led to.
Let's bring in a call now. Rory is joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Rory.
Hi. I have two comments. One, I was in England at the time it had happened, and I believe they actually interrupted the TV show on BBC to announce the bombing. And the other is, I had an uncle who was a physicist in Madison for many years, and I thought he might have been involved in this, losing his work or something, but he had actually changed to a different building a few years earlier.
What was the sentiment abroad about what was happening in the U.S. in the anti-war movement?
I don't really know. We didn't talk about that when I was over there.
Rory, thank you for bringing that. Stu, what effect did the bombing have on the anti-war movement?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. The conventional wisdom is that it did tremendous damage to it. Tom Bates's book, Rads, calls it a true story of the end of the 60s. That may be a little extreme, because the first major protest activity after August of 1970 were the protests against the incursion into Laos by South Vietnamese forces in February 1971. This is, what, 5 months after Army Math. And that went on for 4 days in Madison. There were several hundred and a couple of thousand, at one point 2,500 people having a rally and attempting to march to the Capitol. So, I mean, that's a not insignificant number of people, and to have rallies go on for 4 days. So certainly the anti-war movement continued, but a lot of the joy was taken out. A lot of the sense of moral righteousness was taken out of it. You know, I interviewed Carl Armstrong in Waupun prison before a week before he was released on parole in 1980. And he told me that this is a quote, "Really, I still think the bombing should have been done. And if it had gone as planned, there would have been much more support for it." And this is important. "But the way it turned out, the bombing betrayed not only the anti-war cause, but the entire revolutionary movement." And a few years later, there was a 20th anniversary of the first Mifflin Street Block Party riot. And at this dinner afterwards, Carl got up and said, "I've apologized to a lot of people over the year, but I've never apologized to the left, to all of you who had to deal with the aftermath of what I did. What I did was wrong, and I shouldn't have done it." Now, he says he's maintained that there was a purity of purpose to the activity, to blowing up the building, and it was the fact that Robert Fasnacht was killed that made it a counter-revolutionary act. But it certainly did do damage to the spirit of the movement and the reputation of the movement.
David Schuster, how do you talk with your students about the Vietnam War protests, and how do you think of the Vietnam War today?
Well, don't speak to my students about the Vietnam War protest these days, long time afterwards, except when I explain why I don't hear what they say all the time.
Sure.
But it's a complicated question, because it's relevant today. I'm not the best person to speak about it, I suppose. It's relevant today because there are protests about other things. And for the most part, one has to figure out what's effective, what's just, what's a good cause. Most of them are, in fact, good causes. The reason they're protests is the other avenues are pretty well closed off or non-effective. It's a pity that this needs to happen. But that's the political structural situation that's found everywhere. And so you need those viewpoints to become clear. As to whether it becomes violent, I think it may well be that most of the violence only arises after protests and demonstrations are stopped, shall we say. And usually they're not, such things are not against people, but against property. So it's very complicated. The reason I'm hesitating is I have to think it through now, as you ask me. I don't have a well-formulated position.
That's okay. David, I want to thank you for joining us today. We appreciate hearing you.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
David Schuster is a physicist at Western Michigan University. We have Stu Levitan with us, who is a Madison historian. Now let's bring in Michael Averbach, who was involved in the anti-war movement, a student at UW-Madison at the time in 1970. He went on to teach history for 30 years at Oak Park High School in Chicago. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, tell us what you remember about August 24th, 1970.
Well, I had spent a night away from my normal apartment in Mifflin on Dayton Street. I actually didn't hear the explosion, but the next morning I got word of it. And when it happened, everybody who had been in the movement certainly knew what had taken place. There had been so much agitation around the bomb, around the Army Math Research Center, that we knew immediately what had taken place. And my roommate and I, who were part of the local chapter of SDS called the Mother Jones Revolutionary League, we were given some leaflets. I kind of don't remember where we picked them up, but we were passing them out on the square. And a pretty famous leaflet called Life Among the Trees, that was basically a explanation of why the Army Math Research Center had been bombed, had been assaulted, and its role, the university's role, the complicity it had with research, you know, for the war. So it was kind of an immediate taking to the streets to let people know, a kind of a political education move in defense, I guess you'd have to say, of why the bombing had taken place.
Had you passed out leaflets before?
Oh, yes. Many times in my, this is by now my fourth year on the campus, so I've been pretty active doing pretty much everything.
Were leaflets important in the spread of information? I think about this in our age of social media, when information is so instantaneous around the globe. And how did you spread information about anti-war protests?
Well, those were the days of mimeograph machines and pretty basic methods of getting the word out about issues. It was, in retrospect, you know, compared to today, fairly primitive. You just didn't have the tools that you have today.
And I understand that the FBI agents interviewed you about passing out these leaflets.
So it was a very hot August day, of course, and we weren't up on the square too long when all of a sudden a couple of guys in three-piece suits and sunglasses, sort of out of a movie, seemed to be the FBI uniform, came up to us and asked us who we were and where we got the leaflets. And we found out later that you really, in those circumstances, don't have to answer questions from the FBI. They don't quite have jurisdiction, but we didn't really know that. And told them who we were, told them we really didn't know who had written those leaflets. Probably gave them a pretty neutral answer as to where we'd gotten them.
Well, can we pause right there with Michael Averbach, who was involved in the anti-war movement in 1970 when Sterling Hall was bombed? He's a retired teacher. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Michael Averbach, who was involved in the anti-war movement in 1970 when Sterling Hall was bombed. Madison historian Stu Levitan is here as well, remembering the Sterling Hall bombing 50 years ago this month. The blast in the pre-dawn hours in 1970 killed a 33-year-old postgraduate student, Robert Fasnacht, and the blast injured three other people. The four bombers took aim at the Army Math Research Center, which they thought was aiding the war in Vietnam. Michael, when the FBI interviewed you, you got scared. You went into hiding. What happened?
Well, we kind of figured that this was going to be, if anything, a roundup of people who had been active on campus. And sure enough, that night, we had a knock on the door, and it was either the local police or the FBI again. And they did begin questioning and rounding up, you know, people. And we decided that better to lay low for a while. So my roommate and I moved across town to the east side to a married couple who had an apartment, you know, further away from campus. And we lived there for the next couple of weeks and really didn't communicate with family or friends or other folks in the movement, just to let it all die down and pass. So we kind of went our own version of local underground. And there was a roundup of people and an intense questioning. Of course, they wanted to find out who knew what, who did what. So that's what happened for a couple of weeks.
Stu, tell us what happened to the bombers.
Well, eventually, three of them. Well, they somehow escaped being arrested. They were briefly detained in Sauk County, and because of some paperwork flow, they were not held. They eventually left town, made their way out east, made their way to Canada, split up. They could have been arrested within a couple of weeks, but there was, again, confusion with arrest warrants. Ultimately, Carl was arrested in Toronto in 1972. He was extradited in 1973. He pled guilty in September 1973. The mitigation hearing or the sentencing hearing was a very emotional time in which they tried to put the war on trial. He was sentenced to 23 years and served seven. Dwight was eventually captured and served, I believe, 3 years. David Fine was captured out in San Rafael, California, served about 3 years. Carl would eventually open a juice stand on the mall and a restaurant on State Street, Radical Rye and Chase Lounge. Dwight had some more misfortunes with the law and passed away in 2010. David Fine went to law school, graduated, but the Oregon bar decided he did not have sufficient moral character to be an attorney and so has never been admitted to the bar and works as a paralegal. And Leo Burt has never been found.
Are there any leads there for Leo Burt, where he may be?
No, every so often people say, oh, well, there's a lead, but there's no lead. He was seen, last time he was seen was 1970. Some people think, well, the only way he could have escaped is for so long as if he was a plant. There's no real evidence of that. It's more like, it's very difficult to live on the run for 50 years. So there's the better thinking is that he's probably passed away, but he has never been caught. If I could say one thing, answer part of the question about communications and to highlight the role of the Daily Cardinal and Kaleidoscope and Takeover. The Daily Cardinal, both in terms of Jim Rowan's exposés of Army Math and in terms of editorials. There was a pro-terrorism editorial before Army Math, but after the firebombings had started. Well, if this is what it takes to frighten those fearless people and bring the war home, so be it. Kaleidoscope parroted the basic anarchist line calling for the propaganda of the deed. And its editor, Mark Knopps, ended up serving 8 months in prison for contempt of court for not giving up his sources. In the latter 1970s, Takeover, and Kaleidoscope would also like publish directions on how to make Molotov cocktails. Takeover would pick up the radical mantle in the mid to late 70s. So the role of the underground and the campus press was very critical in the communications, and both in terms of information and exhortation.
We're talking about the Sterling Hall bombing that happened 50 years ago this month with historian Stu Levitan there. Michael Averbach here as well, involved in the anti-war movement in 1970 when Sterling Hall was bombed. Let's bring in a call now. Barb is joining us from Chippewa Falls this morning. Hi, Barb.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. I was on campus in August of 1970. I had summer classes. I also went to school in the fall. I had physics class in Sterling Hall. Remember the rubble? I remember walking past it. I assume my class was relocated. I cannot remember where, but every day I had to walk past that area for where my other classes were. And there were just several years of the air in Madison was basically marijuana and tear gas. It was just, that's how the atmosphere was. The other thing that I remember very clearly, I don't remember how long it took to clear up the rubble or all of that, and during the various other anti-war demonstrations on campus, myself and two of my roommates were on State Street. At that time, there were the city and the campus police were involved in just, breaking up any groups. And three or more people just standing anywhere near the campus were considered illegal assembly. We had just stopped there to make plans for supper where we were going to meet, and a police car drove by and threw a tear gas canister at us so we would move on. And so that's the kind of stuff I just remember. Actually, for several years, I was there from 67 till the very end of 1972. And so I just wanted to share that experience because it does kind of stay with you, and with media being far, far less than now, of course. I don't remember hearing about Mr. Fasnacht being killed there until several days later. So that's just what I wanted to say.
Barb, thank you so much for sharing your remembrance of that time. Michael, what did students make of the bombing? Did they talk about it? Did they think it was justified?
Well, of course, there was a range of opinion, but there's no question that when we found out that the researcher Fasnacht had been killed, that we knew right away that this was sort of up the ante, that this was serious, that now there was a death at the hands of the movement. And however unintentional it was, we knew that the impact on people on campus or whoever heard about the bombing, raised it to a more serious level. And for those of us in the movement, it meant you now have to, if you're going to justify the bombing and the complicity of the university and the war, you now had to talk about this particular death, but also, on the other hand, the destruction wreaked by the war in Vietnam on both Americans and on the Vietnamese. So it was a moral challenge and a political challenge. So I think the impact on students was varied. I mean, some probably wanted to, see protests through and the anti-war movement. Others, I'm sure, said, well, this is a bridge too far.
And we're really short on time here. And I just want to have Stu say, just for a moment here, how did the bombing change the university?
Well, in a physical way, it destroyed a couple million dollars of property and years of research, and almost destroyed the nuclear reactor or some nuclear research. It damaged the reputation of the university even more than Dow and everything else had already up to that point. And it certainly made the state legislature and the regents continue to crack down. Fred Harvey Harrington would soon be gone. It is a continuing mark against the university that we inculcated this, and I don't think it killed the movement because protests continued through the 70s as long as the war went on, but it certainly did take a great deal of joy and spirit out of the movement and made us step up.
Thank you all for joining us. That was Madison historian Stu Levitan, and we talked with Michael Averbach, who was involved in the anti-war protests. Earlier, David Schuster, who was in Sterling Hall at the time of the explosion. This is the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, L. Malik Anderson, Stephen Potter, and Joe Tarr. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Molly Stentz is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.